The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, the Premier League. And now we know that Arsenal are quite good and could challenge after a spirited fight back against Liverpool, who we knew were quite good already. Now we know that Alvaro Morata is quite good after his brace helps Chelsea to another win, keeping up their challenge. And Spurs maintain their challenge after a win at Wolves. Although none of them will actually challenge Manchester City, who scored six. And none of it matters anyway, because in 3 years there's going to be a European Super League that will have no relegation for the rich teams and football will end forever. Also today, Wayne Rooney is back in the England squad, Real Madrid win a game, and a 14-year-old scores a goal in Paraguay. That plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. We have a panel this morning. Mark Langdon from the Racing Post, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Max.
Still rocking your autumn look.
Yeah, I might have overclubbed it a little bit. It's a bit warmer than anticipated. But
at some point, you may disrobe from your beige cardi at some point.
Well, thank you.
If the it's up to you. You have total freedom up to a certain point, I would say. Hey, former professional footballer, Greg Bukowski, how are you?
I'm not a former professional footballer, but, you know, I know you like to think that. So well, that's fine, but I'm good.
Actonians away on Saturday. Are you available?
Maybe, yeah. I recently scored a goal in a Sunday League game, and it was very good. And I don't think I've scored one like that for maybe 20 years. So,
all right. Yeah. Well, I'll amend the spreadsheet. That's good to know.
Might need to be. I don't know if there's a transfer fee. You need to be involved with Tufnell Park Rangers, who have been, turning out for.
Your wages are minus £12.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'll see. I'll have a word with the gaffer.
I'll get my people to talk to your people.
Okay, do it.
Keaton says, after posting how much fun he was having with his life over the weekend, will Barry ever be able to go back to the sad, miserable and lonely routine he had?
I hope so. I really hope so, yes. It was a fun weekend. I went to see our occasional guest and friend of the show, Ellis James, do his day job with John Robbins at Hammersmith Apollo.
And but you weren't just you know, the riffraff in the audience, were you? You were backstage.
Oh, I was hobnobbing with some top celebrities, Welsh comedian Lloyd Langford, Nish Kumar, and Mr. Robbins, Mr. James. So it was all good.
Okay. And you're at the end of a 3-day bender, aren't you, Barry?
The weekend got a little out of hand, but no, it's all good. Actually, speaking of Greg's goal,
yeah,
he was telling me his daughter was there to see him score.
Both daughters and my newborn son, although he won't remember it, obviously.
He might.
Yeah, but that's it. I've done what I needed to do now. I can just retire.
Wait, you can retire after Actonians away on Saturday.
I think she thought I was going to be in the World Cup after seeing it, because it was like a 20-yarder. It kind of went, to the top corner.
Isn't it lucky she saw that, but she wasn't around to see the day Damien Duff ended your hopes of ever having a career as a professional footballer?
I'm glad she didn't see that.
All right, well, let's move on to some actual football. Arsenal 1, Liverpool 1. Greg, this was a great game, I thought.
It was as good as a 1-1 draw gets, I think. And that question of, are Arsenal any good, I think they passed the test comprehensively. They are a good team. And I think against a Liverpool team, Emery showed that he does his homework really well. Everybody knows he's a stickler for detail. And he told his players to press quite high up, and they targeted Fabinho, I thought, who is a new signing, who's taken his time at Liverpool to get into the team. And you can kind of see why, because he doesn't move the ball as quickly as the other Liverpool players in midfield, and he got caught in possession a few times. And I think Arsenal pressing was as good as any team who's played Liverpool this season, and they look really well organised. It gave Liverpool loads of problems, and I think Virgil van Dijk was immense in that game, and needed to be, because Arsenal's attacking play was really, really good. It was a very good game. I thought Liverpool battled hard, and they came through that and got a draw. Although I think Klopp's probably disappointed that they didn't get 3 points. I think a lot of Liverpool fans would say, on the balance of play, a point is a good result against a very good Arsenal team, but probably going to get better as well.
Barry, is Greg being too generous to Fabinho there?
I thought he was the standout terrible player on the pitch. I was actually baffled by how bad that performance was, and presumably he will improve. But Jurgen Klopp was very angry with him and subjected him to a ferocious bollocking on at least two occasions. But he just looked like he was playing at a in slow motion compared to the chaos going on around him, and not in a good way, you know. I was surprised he didn't get hooked. I was surprised he came out for the second half.
I think what Klopp did, like the first half he played in a 4-3-3, and you need every midfielder to be really mobile and good on the ball if you're going to play three in midfield. Second half he went to 4-2-3-1, and he prefers playing as one of two holding players. I wouldn't say he was an awful lot better in the second half, but he didn't get caught out as much. And
if he's not mobile or good on the ball,
I think he's probably okay on the ball. I mean, like for Monaco, he was okay on the ball. I think that was just a massive test because Arsenal is so quick, and they did press Liverpool as good as anybody has this season. I think how good Torreira was for Arsenal also made him look particularly bad, because he's exactly the kind of defensive midfielder I'd have thought Klopp would be interested in, not a big tall player. And there's a debate last night on Match of the Day about whether small players now they thrive, because you need to be able to move your feet so quickly because the game's so fast. And he seems like the kind of midfielder who Mourinho might like, or Rafa in 10 years ago, and not the type of holding midfielder like Kante or Torreira, the smaller terrier types that seem to be good at going forwards as well as going backwards.
Instead of the charity shield, a tallest 11 in the Premier League versus the shortest 11 in the Premier League would be a game I would Sky Plus that one. Mm. Mark, Emery did his homework. Is Emery doing his homework playing a left back at left back? Because there was so much talk before this game of Salah and Mane versus either Xhaka there or Lichtsteiner there, but Kolasinac was put there and played well.
He did play well, but actually the goal came when Iwobi was moved to left back, and he was the one that stepped into that position and put Lacazette through. So I think Emery is showing real variety in his tactical thinking. I mean, I didn't expect him to bring off Aubameyang, for instance, when they're chasing the game, but again, it worked out well for him. I agree that it wasn't only Torreira. I thought Xhaka as well alongside him had one of his best games for Arsenal, and the difference from when we spoke about them after that Man City game on the opening weekend to where they've come in such a short sort of period of time, I think it does bode really well for Arsenal. In saying that, I mean, Liverpool still hit the woodwork twice in the first half, and on another day Van Dijk gets a couple of goals as well as his stellar defensive
and they had a goal chalked off, which should have been
There are actually quite a lot of mistakes that VAR would have cleared up this weekend. Although Marnie did say on that, if you remember when I scored against West Ham, I was offside and that goal counted. This time I was onside and it didn't count, so you just deal with it and accept it.
I'm not sure he even knew he was onside, to be honest, because I was surprised at how little Liverpool's players seemed to complain when the goal was flagged off. They just kind of accepted it. And I think they thought, it's quite possible they didn't know the rule or the law in question, because I would have expected far more of a furore over it, but they took it very calmly and just got on with it. So it was a bit odd. One thing, actually, before Welbeck came on for Arsenal, they were putting a lot of crosses into the box and they didn't have anyone there to get on the end of them, so it was good tactical management by Unai Emery. And the way he micromanages from the technical areas, I'd quite like to just spend a game just watching him rather than the action, because he's fascinating.
You're the kind of viewer that would do my head in then, because I was watching that match and you see the little screen come up at the bottom and they did show Emery for about 5 minutes. So I just said, get Emery out of the way. I don't want to see Emery. I want to see the football now.
Aubameyang, was he... Him playing on that left side, is that a bad thing defensively? If you look at, say, Sane tracks his man so much, and for the Liverpool goal, Aubameyang was out of position.
Yeah,
or is that not fair?
Well, I think they are unbalanced. They've got one too many, really. I mean, that's why Ramsey can't play as well. And I think, ideally, you wouldn't have Aubameyang playing on the left wing, certainly not for a hard game like Liverpool. I mean, I think it's okay for, general bog-standard Premier League matches. But I think he feels that attack is the best form of defence, really. And in terms of that goal, I thought Leno was over-criticised, actually, for his part in that James Milner goal, because it's easy to say after the event that he should have let the ball flash across his goal. But if he does that and Salah taps it in at the back post, then he looks even more ridiculous. And if that there was a deflection off of Holding, and if it wouldn't have done that, then you know, Arsenal would have cleared the ball. So I'm not sure that there'll be. There's too much more they could have done for that goal.
But Lacazette's goal was that was genius centre forward play, wasn't it?
It was just the fact that he trusted himself to be a little bit more patient and not immediately try and blast the ball past Alisson, come back inside and then curl it in. And he had to be very like accurate with where he put it in the goal as well, because there were a couple of players in the way and Alisson. No, it was fantastic.
Are you convinced by Leno and Alisson?
Not entirely convinced. They both should have conceded penalties. The ref sort of gave them both a break. I'm not sure why. Alisson for clattering Mkhitaryan and Leno for doing the same thing to Virgil van Dijk. They're good keepers, but I'm not hugely convinced by either.
I'd say in a similar way to how like Virgil van Dijk's being called like a grown-up when he plays, the way he carries himself. I think there's something about Alisson that he comes across like that, and he could be the same standard as other goalkeepers, but just the way he seems to exude a bit more authority at the back seems to help the defence.
You're a Liverpool fan, Greg.
Mm-hmm.
That away kit, I mean, it upset me.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand that Liverpool need to wear a shirt that isn't red when they play away at Arsenal. That is okay.
It's a bit too blue, isn't it? I mean, in Liverpool, it's been called the wheelie bin kit because all the wheelie bins in Liverpool are purple. So a neutral colour, obviously, with the two clubs. And that seems to just look like wheelie bins, kind of.
Because yeah. They've got the wheelie bin and just the Stabilo marker pen away kits. What's the classic?
I don't know.
Green or yellow?
Well,
right?
White and yellow would be the two Liverpool kits with traditional away kits, the yellow a third kit. And then they brought in a green one in the 90s and that's become a bit more regular. But I don't know, probably doing some kind of market research somewhere, and there's a niche market somewhere in East Asia for, you know, wheelie bin kits.
I like a purple kit, a Fiorentina kit.
But that's the Fiorentina kit, yeah, you know, that's okay.
All right. So.
And that doesn't look cheap, this looks like some kind of knockoff thing you'd buy.
Well, I did the minute-by-minute report on that game, and a reader emailed me to castigate me for saying the kit was purple. He insists it's African violet.
The low point for Liverpool away kits was the tribal tattoo sleeve kit, which I think they wore once, and there was such outrage at it that they just never wore it again. And it was a kit where they'd actually done some kind of tribal tattoo thing on the sleeve. I don't know what they just
this
thought.
Well, obsession.
Footballers like tattoos. Hey, let's put a tattoo on the kit.
There's an obsession with trying to get shirts that look okay with jeans, isn't it? Is that the obsession? I'm sure that was the obsession with the United grey kit, wasn't it? Wolves 2, Spurs 3. This was another fun one, Mark, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. I think Wolves were desperately unlucky, actually, not to get anything out of the game. Lloris probably had his best game of the season. Helder Costa missed an absolutely glorious chance as well. They had the offside goal, that shouldn't have been ruled out. And it was certainly, I think, when Morgan Gibbs-White came on, he changed the game, really, from Wolves' point of view, because they've got players like Moutinho and Neves that are very structured in the way that they play. But this was somebody that added dynamism to that midfield.
Also, to have players of the quality of Neves and Moutinho, I think it was Moutinho went off for him.
It was.
For Gibbs-White to come on and the play to notably, you know, get better the way it did and to be more creative is a really, you know, positive sign for him and for England, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, he is somebody, really. You don't want to put too much pressure on somebody like that, but he is, you know, what you'd be crying out for if he can carry that on. Mm-hmm. And I think he's got a great manager in Nuno to sort of help him along the way. But, I mean, Wolves were given a helping hand to get back into the game from that Trippier attempted nutmeg, is not something you ordinarily see from a right back.
He's got a World Cup hangover, as Kieran Trippier. I don't want, you know, the narrative is that Wolves are brilliant, right? And I'm not trying to say that Nuno is a fraud. They've lost three in a row. They've only won four games this season.
Are you saying Nuno is a fraud?
I'm saying Nuno is a fraud. No, but are they flattering to deceive, Barry? I mean, because they do look good and they create loads of chances, but they are in the, where are they in the table? They're 11th. I mean, it's not bad, is it? But they're not, you know.
Well, I think they've, despite losing 3-0, they seem always to play well in defeat. You know, so I think I'm very impressed with the manner of the performances, most of them anyway, that I've seen. So I don't think they're flattering to see, but yeah, there clearly is some issue there with, you know, clinicalness. They need to be...
More clinical.
More clinical. Thank you. Still, we got there in the end.
They've still got a large majority of the squad is made up of Championship players as well. And so for them to come into the Premier League and just be below mid-table, I would have thought that's par for the course. And in terms of progress, if they'd have signed more players in the summer, it could have upset things a little more.
Could have done a Fulham on it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if you were a Wolves fan, would you be happy?
Yes, I would.
Yeah.
Okay.
They play three at the back as well, and I always think with three at the back, it works against some teams when they don't know how to play against it, against wing-backs. Against other teams that suss you out, you can get torn apart as well.
Well, I think that was the thing, wasn't it? Pochettino quickly moved Lucas into a forward position alongside Harry Kane, and that sort of occupied those three defenders a lot more, and Spurs quickly scored two goals straight after that.
Lamella was good again. He's been involved in 11 goals in his last 12 appearances, 8 goals and 3 assists. How highly do you rate him, Greg?
I think he's a wonderfully talented player. He's obviously had his injury problems. I think what's been apparent with him is, unlike a lot of the other Spurs players, he hasn't played 300 games in the last 12 months, and he looks fresh, and I think that's been the biggest plus point for Spurs with him, that he looks like he's enjoying his football again, and yeah, he just doesn't look like the other ones who sometimes look like they've got lactic acid in their calves and aren't able to kind of get around the pitch as well as he could.
Is it a shame that Juan Foyth didn't give away a hat-trick of penalties? Because Poch said he played well.
Yeah, I feel for him. He's 20 years old. That was his Premier League debut. And so much criticism afterwards. And he played okay in the League Cup game, you know, 2 days beforehand. So,
well, I think he was man of the match in that game, and that's what earned him his debut. But I feel sorry for him. You know, obviously, kid on his debut, you don't want that to happen. But I would point my big finger of blame perhaps in the direction of Kieran Trippier if I was dishing out criticism. But I'm sure he'd be fine. He'd be all right.
And the second penalty is probably a consequence of giving away the first one, and he's panicked, and, you know, because he looked very composed for that first hour. But it was just the third Spurs goal really annoyed me, because one of my big pet hates in football at the moment is when you take the short goal kick and the defender, under pressure, steps inside to the box to sort of kick it and then make for another retake. And so Wolves had the full press on, and Alderweireld did that. And then Lloris booted the ball up to Kane, who flicked it onto Lamella, and Kane scored. But I think that should be a free kick to the opposition now. I don't understand why you get to retake the goal kick. It's too much of an advantage.
That's a fair point. I also don't understand why, and we said this on the pod last week, why Spurs try and play it from the back when it seems like none of their players are quite good enough to do it, and it just ends up with their fullback, you know, playing a blind ball at the line.
I was actually very impressed with the way Arsenal did that against Liverpool, and Spurs just haven't got the hang of it yet.
Sanchez can't play out from the back, and I think that's a big... I know he didn't play or start on Saturday, but he can't do that. I think they're okay when Vertonghen is there, because he can play out. But certainly the big boot up to Harry Kane has got its advantages, I think.
Foyth's boss at Estudiantes, by the way, called him a mix between Baresi and Beckenbauer. So there's no pressure on there. And Canary Yellow, on the subject of Spurs, and presumably he's a Spurs fan, although sounds quite a lot like a Norwich fan from his name. He says, I hope we start playing the Littlest Hobo theme song as our run out song before games. Bournemouth 1, Manchester United 2. This, Barry, was a game of two halves.
It certainly was. Manchester United were as bad, if not worse, as they have been all season in the first half. If after 30 minutes you told me they would win the game, I would have burst out laughing in your face. It was staggering how inept they were, and yet somehow they came back to win the 3 points. And
huge credit to Jose for that.
Well, no, I don't think so. I am loath to give him credit, obviously, but they start matches so badly. You know, Arsenal have been doing as well. Arsenal didn't do it against Liverpool. They were very good throughout. But Manchester United sends his teams out to not concede, to defend. I appreciate that you need to do that, but they're just so much better going forward. And this habit they have of having to go behind, they were so lucky to be level at halftime because Bournemouth missed several good chances. They could conceivably have been 5-1, 5-0 up at the break. And I applaud Jose for turning things around, but I think he deserves criticism for getting them into the position where things need to be turned around in the first place.
I think he's getting more and more confused as well, because he brought Herrera on, who it seemed like he was starting to give up on, and he helped change the game. And previously, Juan Mata seemed to be the player who'd come in and starting to make them play better. He's taken him off now. Does he start him again? And I think from game to game, he's probably got no idea what his best, you know, starting lineup is. And that's a problem in itself, because there's no he's still tinkering with all his tools, and he just can't get the formula right. And they've got really big games coming up now, so he's going to have to quickly.
I'm just disappointed that he didn't praise Ed Woodward after the game, because, you know, Anthony Martial probably wouldn't be at Manchester United if Jose Mourinho had his way in the summer, and he spent all sort of from the summer onwards bemoaning the fact that he wasn't trusted in the transfer market to bring in a defender, and Ed Woodward was to blame for that. So, you know, it goes both ways, isn't it?
But they're only 3 points behind Arsenal. I mean, it is interesting, isn't it, that there's the story of Arsenal is this incredibly positive change, and obviously a lot comes down to the actual football that people are watching. But Jose's argument about points last season, they were still quite boring and came second, but still, is it as bad? Or, I mean, I'm just wondering if we are guilty of just.
Well, if you watch that first half, they were calamitously bad, like dreadful. So there's no getting away from that. That's a fact.
Yeah. And they've had a reasonable run of fixtures as well recently, and the games they've not performed in are games they'd be expecting to do a lot better against teams. I know Bournemouth were above United, they still are, aren't they, as he went into that game, but that's Bournemouth, who traditionally they would be on the front foot against when they go away from home. They wouldn't start as tentatively as they did.
I would say that I thought the second half was probably there was a 30-minute period that was their best football of the season, when they did create a lot of chances, and it was quite exciting to see, a bit like that Newcastle comeback, actually, when they started to throw men forward, and, you know, Pogba playing in the position where we saw him do so much damage for Juventus, sort of the left channel, and then that's where the winning goal came from.
Because he was really bad in the first half, but then when Ander Herrera came on, Pogba got to go forward and basically ran the show.
You could say as well, Bournemouth are a very good team to play against. When you turn things to your advantage, Eddie Howe will stick to his principles as well and continue to play, so therefore there will be space for the Man United team against a team such as Bournemouth, rather than a more defensive team like Brighton, perhaps, at the, you know, who are further down the league.
I did feel for the stewards. I mean, stewarding is a sad job for anyone, but when Martial scores that winner, and then the stewards have to, obviously they have to do something, but they're just caught in this sandwich where, you know, they don't want to be there. The players don't want them to be there. The fans don't want them to be there. It's just a sad place to be.
Don't you think it's actually quite a bit of insight into what it's like being a professional footballer and getting mobbed by the crowd? Because you are probably closer to the fans than the player is.
Oh, I see. So, it's a bit like the Betway man who says he's like a real sportsman. You're like, no, you're just chauffeuring a golfer there.
Score a winner at Bournemouth? Well, I can tell you.
So what the stewards should do is arc their run and celebrate. It's a bit like there's one team I play against and their pitch is right by Saracens, and if Saracens are playing at the same time and you're on the attack when Saracens are on the attack, you just hear the crowd and you're like, wow, this is extraordinary. Poppy watch, Nemanja Matic wasn't wearing a poppy.
Why does he hate the British Armed Forces? The brave boys?
Well, there's no official, I don't think there's been an official response. He's worn it in the past, but it could be to do with the Balkan conflict and Kosovo being recognised as a country, and he's Serbian, and Serbia don't recognise Kosovo as a country.
And of course, Shaqiri's not travelled with Liverpool for their game away to Red Star Belgrade in the Champions League, just to sort of calm any tension that may have been created from him going to that game.
Yeah, it's like Mkhitaryan not going to
Azerbaijaners and Armenian. I mean, it is a sad state of affairs when footballers can't go and play football.
I also think it's probably a tactical thing by Klopp in terms of the atmosphere at Red Star, because they're back in the Champions League anyway, is going to be incredible. Add another, you know, another bit of gas on the fire for that one, and it makes your players' jobs perhaps harder than what it would be. So
I'd be intrigued actually to see what the atmosphere is like at that game, because I had to do an article on Red Star earlier this season, their return to the Champions League, and I was quite puzzled to note their average attendance for league games is only about 6,000 or 7,000, and I presume they'll have a full house for this Champions League game. So, yeah, it should be interesting.
Wayne Rooney is in Manchester United news. Ex-Manchester United player, everyone. Wayne Rooney played for them for some time. Is being recalled to the England squad for a one-off farewell performance 2 years after his last appearance for the national side in a friendly against the USA on the 15th of November. Craig says, after Rooney being recalled, do we think it's only right that Heskey has one final goodbye? how do we feel about Wayne Rooney? Obviously, some people are saying this is the end of football again. I mean, it seems a bit strange, but it's all right, isn't it?
Just total indifference, you know. I don't see... I find it odd, but yeah, I have no particular problem with it.
Yeah, I guess if you're Callum Wilson, you might. If you thought you might have a chance of being called up to play in a game that doesn't really matter much for England to prove what you can do. But again, I'm similar to Barry in that it's been done. This has been done before. Like Podolski did it with Germany. Maybe not a 2 year gap between his one performance and the next, but it was about 9 months. And then he came back and scored a wonder goal to beat England 1-0 in a friendly. So it, you know, this thing's been done. Was it Schneider?
Schneider and
sat
Robin
on a,
have
sat
both
on a sofa in the middle.
They both had
looking
it
at his highlights.
That sofa was so brilliant.
I'm not quite sure though what we're celebrating with Wayne Rooney. I mean, you have a look at sort of his tournament record, and he had a great Euro 2004, but then he was sent off at 2006 World Cup. They didn't qualify for 2008. In 2010, it was the Algeria-USA debacle, and he was having a go at the crowd.
Are we saying the highlights when they put him on a chair at Wembley? Show him all these highlights.
You should host this highlights show.
But if you think back to sort of Euro 2012, when he went to Vegas on holiday before the tournament and wasn't fit... in 2014, they were out after two matches. And in 2016, they were beaten by Iceland with him playing as like a quarterback, sort of self-designated midfield role. So
I have revised my opinion and think this is a terrible, terrible idea. And Callum Wilson should be called up immediately after his excellent performance against Manchester United.
Let's be honest, Wayne, you've only ever done against the Orlando Pirates.
I mean, I suppose they could... How big's the squad? 23, normally?
I think so, yeah.
Maybe they'll surely make it 24. I mean, Southgate's smart enough to go, well, look, if I say he's a bonus member, then it...
Maybe they bring him on for the last 10 minutes and his charity gets a lot of money and that's important, I suppose. So.
And then, they get a penalty and Wayne's allowed to... Or Wayne, like the US defence split apart. Alexi Lalas just goes for a walk and he just gets to stroll through and score a pity goal at the end.
Well, I just wonder, it feels a bit sort of soccer aid, doesn't it? I didn't have Jamie Finkston would be in goal. We'd have Ralph Little at left back.
It's an international testimonial, isn't it? Which is a new thing.
But being sort of semi-serious about it, if you're saying Pochettino, could you not then say, well, you know, what's Harry Kane doing in this glorified testimonial? I don't want him playing. You know, you can sort of sell a friendly as we're preparing for the Euros and Nations League. I just wonder if maybe one or two club managers be a little bit upset.
Producer Jonathan says, surely most of his last 50 caps were charity related. some Welsh bashing the English there. West Ham 4, Burnley 2. I don't know if it's just me, but I just... The sight of Joe Hart sort of looking sad or disappointed when he's conceded a goal has just happened so many times now that I'm not saying, you know, put him out of his misery. It just makes me sad now. It's got that far.
I don't think Joe Hart has ever recovered from that time that Andre Pirlo made a fool of him at
Euro 2012.
Presumably a game that Wayne Rooney doesn't want to remember.
I think, you know, he was giving it the grobbler and Pirlo just absolutely made him look a clown. And I think that started his decline. He's was a very fine goalkeeper. He's still decent enough, but you know, his career has been on a downward trajectory ever since.
Having said that, I don't think he was particularly to blame for
not at all for
many of West Ham's goals, because West Ham just played, their attacking football was really good. It was a very odd game in that they did a very un-West Ham-like thing in that they got pegged back to 2-2 all. And whereas last season there would have been a sense of dread around the stadium and you could see them getting beat, they rallied and they came back and they look like a team now who've got a bit of backbone and they're playing very positively. And I thought Felipe Anderson was wonderful. His performance was fantastic. Arnautovic has been their best player most of the season, but Anderson's taken a little bit of time to get going and now looks like he could possibly be like a long-term replacement for Payet, who was, you know, their star player for a couple of seasons and was behind them doing very well at that time. So some of his skill and passing ability and the shot, the volley he had, which was hit first time with the outside of his foot, which Hart had to beat away, he just looks like a class player.
It was a big game for Anderson because he got a lot of stick on Wednesday. I was at the London Stadium for the cup defeat to Tottenham, and that the fans really picked on him. His set pieces weren't good, and he's deemed to be lazy and not tracking back. So I think it was important for him to kind of have that kind of game and the impact that he had, sort of showing exactly why West Ham bought him, and you know the kind of form that he had shown for Lazio, which was getting him linked with Manchester United not that long ago. So he definitely needed that performance.
It's about having the right components as well. So a player who perhaps he seen it as a bit of a free spirit role in the team, then he's allowed to do that rather than have to just do the kind of shuttle runs up and down the left of midfield.
It's interesting because this game, the West Ham Burnley game, when West Ham had that terrible start and you looked at their fixture list, this was the first game where you thought, actually, this might be their first win or first points of the season. And they've certainly surprised a few, haven't they? On the other end of it, Burnley is Sean Dyche under pressure or not?
He's not under pressure, no. But I think that they are in danger of relegation this season for sure. I mean, when you look at the shot stats, 22-6 and shots on target, 10-3. They were well beaten, even if they managed to get back into the game a couple of times. 13 goals conceded in their last three matches. Okay, two of those were to Chelsea and to Man City. But you then look at the highlights of that game, and actually West Ham could have had more than the four goals. Yeah. There was a definite penalty. They hit the woodwork. There was a miraculous recovery from Ben Mee.
It was amazing, wasn't it?
It was. It was one of the saves of the season, really. Joe Hart made a good save from Arnautovic as well. So, I mean, this is not like the Burnley team that we've expected in the last couple of years, where they give up a lot of shots but not big opportunities. Mm-hmm. Now that they're doing both.
But then the home record isn't particularly good this season either. And in the past, that's what they've been. They're good. Good seasons have been built on being solid at home, and they haven't looked as solid at home this season as they have in the past.
Since he last played for Manchester City, Joe Hart, he's kept just 11 clean sheets in 66 league games for Torino, West Ham and Burnley, conceding 126 goals. But we should bring him back for an international. Has he? He's not retired, has he?
No.
He's got his Legends pitch at Man City, hasn't he? Have you seen that? The Joe Hart training pitch.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, that is nice. I think it's nice to be nice, isn't it? What a way to end part one. We'll be back in a minute. We'll start with the regulation wins for Chelsea and Man City yesterday.
Today in Focus is a new Guardian podcast that brings you closer to our journalism by getting behind the news every weekday. You'll join me, Anushka Astana, talking to people at the centre of the big stories impacting our world. We'll use personal perspectives and expert analysis to put you at the heart of what matters. Listen to Today in Focus and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you choose to listen.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. On the 29th of November at the Emmanuel Centre in London, it is the Guardian Football Weekly Christmas special. I'm going to be there. Barry, you're going to be there.
Great.
Jonathan Wilson's going to be there.
Very good.
And still to be announced. Langdon or Bukowski, do you want to throw your name in the ring?
It should be an X-Factor thing, you know.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. We could bring everyone there.
Yeah.
And what, you sing a song?
I'll just do an anecdote, I think.
What would your anecdote be? Because
I've done all my anecdotes.
Well, it's all right. I may have repeated an anecdote once or twice. You could do your Duff one.
I'll live it up over the next 4 weeks and see if I can find an anecdote.
Oh, great. Would you come with an anecdote to see if you're allowed on?
On TalkSport, Danny Kelly's very fond of my night out with Patrick Cliver.
But here we go.
Oh.
Most of it's not actually broadcastable, so we'll have to tell you off air.
That's not good enough, is it?
Nightclub Patrick.
Where were you?
Turin.
In Turin? Is it just you and Cliver?
No, there was a group of us, and Cliver was there trying to keep himself to himself, I think. But we sort of dragged him into...
Was it a moment of madness?
He probably feels like that, yeah. Not for me. I've got a great picture of it.
Okay, right. Was there anything illegal involved?
No. It was in Antonio Conte's brother's bar as well.
Oh, really?
Okay.
Well,
that's celebrity hobnobbing on Friday.
It's definitely not going to win, I don't think.
Pale into insignificance.
Chelsea 3, Crystal Palace 1. I said regulation before the break, but actually... Greg, I thought Palace played quite well for 60 minutes, and slightly unfair that Chelsea can just bring on Hazard and Kovacic.
Yeah, that's what Conte's got that luxury now, though, because other players are playing. So he's got Barkley in midfield, who's now playing a lot better, so therefore he can afford to have Kovacic on the bench. And I thought Morata, perhaps another player who, a few weeks ago, Barkley said he, for the first time since he was 16, was being coached again under Sarri. He's improving him, telling him what to do, where to run, little improvements to his game. Maybe Morata is a player who could similarly be improved under Sarri. I don't think he doesn't benefit from having Hazard on the pitch with him usually, because Hazard likes to play off Giroud, because Giroud can play with his back to goal a bit more and hold the ball up. But I think Morata, two goals for him, the confidence that'll give him might, you know, again, Chelsea have played well this season already. If they start to have another striker who is knocking at the door and wanting to get into the team, I think they could improve even more.
And actually, his first touch for both goals was really good, especially the first goal, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really good.
The hat-trick chance, though, Mark... I mean, I don't have a problem with him trying a cheeky chip when they've won the game. But,
that's perfectly acceptable.
I've heard criticism saying, well, Alan Shearer wouldn't have done that.
Yeah, but I mean, he could have blasted it and still missed. So, I mean, I'd think that always... I mean, it was the end of the game. He was trying to... You know, he's had a tough time. I think he was just trying to bring a bit of joy. I don't really have an issue with it. I don't know if Barry disagrees, though.
No, I don't. I think it's a good sign, because it shows he was confident enough to try it. And Sarri said afterwards that mentally he's been a little bit fragile. So he's clearly got his confidence back, and that can only be a good thing.
Wayne Hennessy is 6'6".
Yeah, but, you know, the game was won. Why not? Have a go.
Did Chelsea do the right thing with Wilfried Zaha? I mean, there were so many people around him, it looked like a game of kabaddi to me.
Well, that's kind of how you beat Palace, isn't it? You stop Zaha having any influence on the game, because this season, probably last season, there weren't that many other contenders to step up. I think Townsend, you know, he can do it in fits and starts at times, but Zaha just makes everything happen for Palace.
It's that famous commentary, I think it's from Barry Davis in the 91 semi-final, when he said Lineker's used him by not using him. And I think that Palace maybe need to do that with Zaha. You know, if Chelsea want to put 3 and 4 players around him, then look for somebody else, because you've got to trust in the ability of Townsend and you know, some of your other players, because there will be space elsewhere.
You're saying Zaha should sort of wander back to his own corner flag and see 4 players
I think that... maybe that, you know, we're going to extremes there, but I definitely think that he could, you know, he could take 3 players out of the game by just standing out on that flank. And the goal had nothing to do with Zaha, and that there was space, there were spaces elsewhere.
What did you make of the Palace kit, Max? I thought it was
absolutely tremendous. And I have been quite vocal in A, unnecessary away kits, and B, like Liverpool, you know, horrible away kits. I thought that was tremendous.
Classic, yeah. You used to design a kit like that on kickoff too. Do you remember that?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, very nice.
Oh, that was a good one. It's with Steve Screech. And somebody sent me, I used to get Amiga Power delivered in the 90s, and I used to be made to do weird essays by my English teacher, like boiling an egg or mowing the lawn, like, you know, to be creative.
Yeah, this is bizarre.
And so when I was a stupid 13-year-old, I'd just send these English essays to Amiga Power, and they printed one of me about mowing the lawn. It was my first step on the ladder. I also of think show
very
business.
Flowery prose.
Yeah.
Why is it an essay about mowing the lawn randomly published in a computer games magazine?
They were the 90s, great times.
I think Kickoff 2 was partly responsible for football in England being set back maybe 10, 15 years, because all you could do in that game was hoof it upfield because it was impossible to dribble because the ball didn't stick to your players.
Absolutely, you had to hold the button to control the ball.
Exactly. Now
you?
The modern age of games, you can just dribble and do all these skills and tricks and flicks, and you know, it's obviously helped.
On Striker on the Amiga, it was quicker to slide tackle down the pitch than sprint.
Did you see the Andreas Iniesta, Lucas Podolski computer game goal scored in Japan over the weekend?
No, I didn't.
Absolutely outstanding. Lucas Podolski, I thought he was running a kebab shop somewhere in Cologne, but he is playing with Andres Iniesta at Vissel Kobe in Japan. And just you seek it out on the internet. It's well worth a couple of minutes of your time. This glorious scooped pass from Andres Iniesta just over the entire defence, and Lucas Podolski runs in behind to volley home.
Press square, and it went in the top corner.
Yeah, it was like something from a computer game. Wonderful.
Manchester City 6, Southampton 1. Actually, speaking of computer games, there is a clip doing the rounds where it does look like the Harlem Globetrotters, doesn't it? It's just like each one of the City players, they don't actually score in that attack, but they all just have a little go and they just give it to someone else and he runs along.
It's a game of Rondo, like on the 6-yard box, where Southampton players just cannot get anywhere near the ball.
Do you remember the Emirates? They used to get frustrated, didn't they, when Arsenal used to pass it on the edge of the 18-yard box, but this was on the edge of the 6-yard box, wasn't it?
I have a question, right? And it's slightly facetious, but if Southampton had played a back four, right, and then in front of that another back four, and then two holding midfielders, and they just literally played, and I know Newcastle sort of did this, but didn't, they still played midfielders and strikers, would it have been any worse?
It'd have been 10 times better, because Mark Hughes tried to press City by playing the formation that was quite high up the pitch, and yet none of his players actually did any pressing, so therefore there was just massive holes for City to pick in them. And I do think it was really naive to think they could go to Manchester City and do that, perhaps, when these players don't do that week in, week out anyway.
Max, I think Gary Neville maybe had the same idea. I don't want to knock his Valencia managerial career too much. I think it was a bad time for the whole club. But when he went to Barcelona away, he played with his defence, and then he put two defenders in, two extra fullbacks into the team. And I think they lost by 7 that night.
But I was generally wondering, thinking, you play a back four, right, and then another back four. Okay, maybe you play one striker, and you just tell him you stand on the halfway line. So that means, or what about if you play two strikers? Because then you've got to have three defenders against two strikers, haven't you?
I don't think Pep would. Not if it was Shane Long and somebody else.
Well, they just have Edison standing there. I'll sweep up. Well, I did wonder. I just sort of think you've got to sort of be creative now, haven't you, when you go to City?
I think you've got to try to keep the ball. I think that's your best way, and to try to hurt City. I mean, maybe not to the extremes that Mark Hughes went to, but if you just sit there sort of, waiting for them to score, they will just score.
City presses as well as any team in the league, and that's the problem. You could try and keep the ball, but technically, no other teams aren't as good. There's maybe two or three teams in the league are able to keep the ball under pressure from City. Other teams can't. So therefore, you're going to give it away, and then you're going to have to be in defensive, back into your defensive position very quickly.
I just want someone to try it. I want somebody. Because you say, look, we probably weren't going to win. See why? Because you could just do it in five. It's like a training ground move, right? You do it in 5-minute sections. You say every 5 minutes, and you just every time you get it, you just whack it as far as you can.
someone will get sacked soon, and Allardyce will be back in work, won't he?
So. I mean, there's potential, isn't there, for maybe a Man City Middlesbrough League Cup semi-final, and Tony Pulis would definitely
come
give
on,
that a
Tony,
go.
Do it for me, please. This is from Philip Blundell on Twitter. It says Liverpool, Spurs, Chelsea, Arsenal and City have played 39 games that weren't against each other or Manchester United this season. 35 wins, 3 draws, 1 defeat. At what point do neutrals stop watching? I mean,
well, sorry, just on the same team, there's a stat in today's Guardian. This is the first time since the 78-79 season that three top flight teams have gone unbeaten in their opening 11 games of the league campaign.
But you can't have it both ways. We want the top 4 or 5 to be tight, and that's only going to happen if they beat everyone else.
Yeah, they've
right?
got all the other teams have got to do what City did last season, which is beat all the teams outside the top four or five teams in the league, and therefore you get a proper title race. If they don't beat those teams, then City just run away with it, and yeah, everybody moans about the title being done and dusted in March.
I think, you know, that game between Liverpool and Arsenal, as good as it was, I think illustrates, well, my theory why I think City will win the league possibly by even more than they did last season. And that's because the teams directly beneath them taking points off each other and, you know, dropping points against, you know, we moaned about the quality of the teams, say, outside the top seven last season. And I just think the gulf is getting bigger and bigger.
But I thought you thought Bournemouth and Wolves are good and fun.
They are good and fun. You know, we praise Bournemouth to the high heavens. I think they deserve criticism for not beating Manchester United on Saturday. But, you know, there is a lot of dross there, and the numbers don't lie.
I think. Well, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's interesting. City have gone to Liverpool and they've drawn there. They've gone to Spurs. They've beaten them. It's when the big teams go to City, I think, well, that'll be the test. And maybe they will just win those games and then they wrap the title up. But I still think it'll be a closer points gap between them winning it and whoever comes second than it was last year.
I think the excitement comes, and maybe not all of the games have been brilliant, but just between those big six now. I mean, you almost guarantee one a week. It feels like we are at the moment anyway, where that is where your entertainment comes from. It's the Manchester United trip to Chelsea the other week that was, you know, 2-2. And, you know, we just have to accept that, you know, teams outside the top six, probably the best time to watch them is when, say, Bournemouth are playing Wolves or whatever. And, you know, that's where your entertainment will ultimately come from.
Cardiff City 0, Leicester City 1. An emotionally charged win for Leicester. And you sort of quite often hear that cliche, oh, you can see it really meant a lot to them, Barry. But you get the impression that there was a lot of raw emotion there from the Leicester players and management team as well.
They were all clearly had, you know, a lot of time for their former boss, and some of them are visibly upset. You know, Kasper Schmeichel, there's a picture in the paper today, Jamie Vardy kneeling in prayer at a temple in Bangkok where they've all gone to pay their respects. And it was a difficult day. Cardiff deserve immense credit for doing everything right, making it as easy as possible for Leicester. And, you know, the result was irrelevant, but it was nice that they won.
I also think a lot's been talked about the grief that Leicester players have had to deal with. I think there's a lot of them have been traumatised, I think, because it's a helicopter crash that happened outside the ground. A lot of them, I mean, Schmeichel saw it come down, other players probably heard it come down, and they saw the immediate aftermath. And I think they've had to deal with that this week, and that's something that's very difficult to get out of your mind. And I think the game was probably very important for them in terms of part of the healing process. And you know,
I mean, Schmeichel apparently had to be held back from trying to help when he saw the crash. And he spoke, I think, on Match of the Day, he spoke really eloquently about that. Demarai Gray, after the game, spoke very eloquently as well for such a young man. He was booked by Lee Probert for taking off his shirt to reveal a tribute to Vijay Srivaddhanaprabha. And I don't know what, you know, Lee Probert has come under intense criticism for this. It is a law. I don't know if I think it's a, is it. What do you think about this?
I mean, I think that Lee Probert was. It's an awkward position for him. I mean, he has to. He can't allow. I don't think you can allow sort of outside influences to dictate sort of what laws you decide to sort of clamp down on, if you like. I'm sure he didn't want to do it, and he would have fully understood.
He clearly, you know, Winston was like, oh God, I
thought Claude Puel spoke very well on it after the game. And, you know, if he's accepted it and the Leicester squad have accepted it, fine. I don't see why everybody else is getting so worked up about it.
Yeah, as an example, Billy Sharp, I think, scored a few days after he lost his son and revealed a message. And the referee in that case, Darren Demon, kept his cards in his pocket. But
well, it's personal discretion, I suppose. Lee Probert could have kept the card in his pocket. That could have cost him a gig next week, or he might have been demoted for a week. I don't think it's a big deal. I probably would have left it in my pocket if I was in his position, but I can understand why he showed it. And I think this fury being directed towards him is ridiculous, but that's the way of the world these days.
Mm. Everton 3, Brighton 1. Barry Richarlison is still a massive waste of money, as we said.
Absolutely.
At the start of the season, isn't he? And Everton 4 wins out of 5, creeping up to the promised land of 7th. I know we sort of mocked them, but they've got something this season.
Some of their summer signings are starting to find their feet now. Andre Gomez, he's a really technically gifted passer, and Bernard is a really creative, buzzy kind of player who plays between midfield and attack. And they're starting to get in the groove, and Everton are starting to look more creative when they go forwards, because they did look a little bit routine. I think at the beginning of the season. They didn't look like they could actually create chances for Richarlison. And Richarlison is the kind of forward who, I know he scored a lot of goals this season, but he really thrives off little passes pinged through to him and passes by defenders like Lewis Dunk gave him, which was a wonderful finish. I don't know people who haven't seen the third goal, one of my favourite moves a footballer can do is when they just knock it to the side of a defender. It's like it's not a nutmeg, but it's as good as a nutmeg, and you can see them. They just know they're done because they're off to buy a paper or get a taxi or something. And Richarlison went through and finished it wonderfully well.
Seamus Coleman's celebration was very angry, wasn't it? I mean, it looked almost. I don't think I've ever been that angry about anything.
He's a very laid back man normally as well, and he was cupping his ears to the Gladys Street end, and because he has been criticised over the last few weeks for some of his displays, and he was a great finish, and he's a player who needs to get in his groove, because he's had obviously that horrible injury to get over, and then he's had a bit of a stop start comeback from that, and he looked like he was getting back to his form against Brighton.
Newcastle 1, Watford 0. First win for Newcastle since May, when they beat Chelsea 3-0 on the last day of the season, which is presumably what got Antonio Conte sacked, didn't it? But look, good, they've got a win, Mark. That's a great start, isn't it, November?
It's strange, because they've played better on a number of occasions this season, most notably against Brighton, and not got the win. This time they were outplayed for most of the game, but I think over the course of the season they probably deserved that little bit of luck, and now maybe things can start to calm down and Benitez can just concentrate on the football. There's too much still going sort of outside of that club, even this week with Lascelles signing the new contract, saying that Mike Ashley was a nice guy, immediately sort of winding up 50,000 Newcastle fans in the process. So a very important victory for them. I still expect three worse teams than them this season.
And he says,
did Lascelles get abuse at the weekend, do you know?
I think that it was,
I know Benitez called on the crowd not to.
I think that did calm the situation down, as far as I'm aware.
Andy says, is Watford's away strip their way of trying to confuse the opposition by looking like they have 10 goalkeepers playing? It didn't work.
Well, Sunderland have played in green away kit and looked like there were 11 goalkeepers. It really wasn't a good look.
But I reckon if you put Watford in their home kit, you'd be able to tell yourselves apart from Newcastle. And it's just a bugbear of mine, right?
You're saying they would have got a result if they'd won the home kit?
I reckon if they'd won their home kit, they'd have a better chance. Mm. Yes. Huddersfield-Fulham tonight, Shane says, is Fulham-Huddersfield the cup final of the bad Premier League teams? I'm a Fulham fan, by the way. Huddersfield's still the only team in the 92 without a win in the league so far this season. Huddersfield have been in the lead for just 16 minutes this season. As far as winless streaks go, Ipswich took until their 12th game in the Championship to win at Swansea. Fulham have one win. They beat Burnley 4-2 at the end of August. For some unhappy Joe Hart faces.
Huddersfield, the team who can't score against Fulham, the team who can't defend. Something's got to give, Derby.
Well, Huddersfield also can't defend, because in their respective last league games, they were both hideously bad at the back, almost comically inept. So it should be an interesting game.
It could be 5-5.
It could be a really good game, or it could be the worst game we've ever seen.
I mean, no Premier League manager has left their position yet this season, but there was talk, wasn't there, that Jukanovic was under sort of intense pressure. I know Fulham have come out and said that's not the case, but you just wonder if they lose to Huddersfield as well with the international break coming up, it wouldn't be a good look.
In the Football League, Leeds are top of the Championship after a 2-1 win at Wigan. Kemar Roofe scored the winner. Not with his hand, so that's good. After a calamitous defensive mix-up in the Wigan defence, Josh says, is it Marcelo Bielsa's duty to buy Ibai Gomez, currently at Alaves, to play in Yorkshire? Ibai Gomez. Are there any other players whose names fit well with the local dialect? That's one for below the line. Norwich City are second after their fourth win on the bounce, a 4-0 win at Hillsborough. All the goals in the second half. At the bottom, we can sound the outfield player in goal, Claxon Barry.
Yes, yes, indeed we can. Ipswich failed to beat a Preston side that had a goal-scoring substitute striker in goal for the final 15 minutes of their game. Callaghan, was it?
Paul Gallagher.
Gallagher, sorry, yeah. Paul Gallagher. So, yeah, that it's always good to see, and hats off to him. I'm not sure how much work he had to do or if he was forced to make any saves, but...
I saw Alex Neil, the Preston manager, say that he wasn't supposed to go in goal. Yeah. They had somebody else to go in, but Gallagher just really fancied it. So.
Also, you've just scored, and then... You've been on the pitch 1 minute, you've scored. Surely you're fancying scoring another goal and you put your hand up to go in.
Sometimes like, you go out on the pitch, especially as a sub, and it's hard to get the pace of the game. You might have scored and thought, actually, I'm a bit knackered.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll just have a bit of a rest.
I think now Niall Quinn remains the king, doesn't he, for scoring a goal for Man City, then saving a penalty from Dean Saunders.
I thought Phil Jagielka had done that for Sheffield United many years ago as well.
Yeah,
but he went in goal and for the full half and saved a penalty.
Stoke nil, Middlesbrough nil. A classic Tony Pulis. They both played back four, two holding midfielders. Krasenstein writes, who would win in a fight between one poppy-sized James McLean and 100 human-sized poppies? The abuse that he was getting as he walked off the pitch, it's done around on social media. It's just unbearably depressing, isn't it? I can't...
Yeah,
don't we don't need to say any more about it, do we?
Well, he has responded to the abuse on Twitter or Instagram and may very well have got himself into hot water over his perfectly justified retorts to those who are abusing him. But it is just so tedious now. It's his decision. It should be respected and... I don't want to talk about it anymore.
He described some of the fans as, quote, uneducated cavemen.
Hmm. That seems perfectly reasonable.
As opposed to educated cavemen. Not sure how good tertiary education was back in caveman days.
Somebody had to have the idea to, you know, rub the sticks together and or bang the two bits of rock.
On MA and mammoth hunting. The FA are investigating that social media post, by the way. In League One, a fun 6 minutes in Scunthorpe. I don't know if anyone has ever had that, but... They were 3-0 down at home to Oxford with an hour gone, and by the 66th minute it was 3-3. And that's how it finished. Well done, Scunny. Fair play to the 1,305 Sunderland fans who went on the 800-mile round trip to Plymouth. They're second, 3 points behind Portsmouth, who won at Bradford. You won at Plymouth, Barry, just in case you didn't
2-0.
Know. And good news, Peterborough lost. In League Two, good news as well, Cambridge United won their third game in a row, 1-0. Against Grimsby with a late goal up to the giddy heights of 19th. The top three is Lincoln, MK Dons and Colchester. They all won. Matty, a York fan in non-league, says, are there degrees of shithousery? I saw something yesterday at York versus Bradford Park Avenue that was so shithouse that it should really have an extra name like shit mansion, shit hotel, shit block of flats, shit estates. Any help appreciated? Cheers. I asked him what happened and he said, oh, well, our centre-back was sent off for... barely clipping the opposition striker in the face with his forearm. I went and found the YouTube highlights, and it does very much look like their centre-back elbowed the opposition striker in the face. In fact, his own manager said, it's a sending off. The captain of the club goes and does what he did. It's not good enough. There's no need to do it. It's just stupid. So I don't know if there are other degrees of shithousery, but that was just poor from your captain. Fitbar, Barry, take it away.
Top of the table clash in the Scottish Premiership. Hearts took on Celtic and got absolutely slaughtered, 5-0. So the gap between the two teams is now down to 1 point. Craig Levein held his hand up afterwards and basically said it was all his fault. The manager is an idiot, said the manager. I thought with all the high-profile games we've had, our energy levels were beginning to wane. I made the decision to try to sit in for straight Celtic and hit them on the counter-attack, but I got that one wrong, eh? So that's fair enough. I mean, it should be noted that Hearts are missing a lot of players through injury. But it's a worrying result for them. And Rangers beat St Mirren. Alfredo Morelos scored again and was hit by a coin thrown from the crowd. This time it was only 50p, so the economy has clearly suffered a bit since the Hearts Hibs derby last week when Neil Lennon was hit by a pound coin. And Daniel Candias was sent off for Rangers. He's got two yellow cards, and nobody seems quite sure why the second one was shown to him, because he was basically booked for being held in a headlock by Anton Ferdinand. I think he was goading some of the St Mirren players after he'd scored with a fluke. It was one of those crosses that went in. And
I'm just coming to terms with knowing where Anton Ferdinand is, if I'm honest.
Were you surprised? Did you not know he was at St Mirren? Yeah, I had thought he was in Turkey.
Did you say that goal was considered a fluky cross? Because I saw that and thought it looked like an amazing goal.
I thought cross.
I think he conceded afterwards it was a cross. That was their first goal. So it was his overzealous celebrations riled up Anton Ferdinand after the second goal, and he was put in a headlock and got booked.
Maybe Anton Ferdinand was as surprised as I was to be in St Mirren. Fair play to Matty, the York fan, who somehow... Well, I don't think he's not listening, because no one can be listening while we're doing it. He's literally just tweeted me going, fair enough, he does look over his shoulder before throwing the arm out. Amazing what a bad view and a partial crowd can do.
That's just weird.
That is really quite strange.
Is that like the Miles McLagan of this studio?
That'll do for part two. In part three, we'll go all European. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain. Sid Lowe's out there. How you doing, Sid?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm marvellous, thanks. Real Madrid won a football match.
Well, that's exactly how Toni Kroos put it, which I thought was brilliant. Did you see his tweet? Toni Kroos literally put out a tweet that just said, "We won a league game, full stop."
Well, it's good to be just honest and open, isn't it?
It's taken six matches for it to happen. Here's the thing. They were bloody awful. I mean, they were genuinely terrible, Real Madrid. By at least much, much the better side. And I think in a way, this is a game that kind of tells you more about the politics than anything else, and about the kind of the pressures that are building at Real Madrid and the way that people are positioning themselves. Of which, you know, more in a minute. Let's begin with the game itself. Valladolid had two very, very good chances that they missed in the first half, hit the bar twice in the second, another very good chance which Courtois saved. He then made another good save, which maybe, you know, would have been bad if he let it in, but was still a good save. And Madrid really didn't respond at all. But then Vinicius Junior came on, Gareth Bale went off, Lucas Vazquez came on, Marco Asensio went off. Those two kind of had the finger of blame pointed at them a little bit. And Vinicius scored the goal. And the reason why I talk about politics is that this has been building for a long time. You know, this is their big summer signing. He's only 18. Huge amount of debate, really exaggerated debate around him. A huge amount of kind of media pressure, which isn't done in a vacuum. You know, this comes from certain elements of the club. It comes from the fact that this is a club signing, the desire to see him pushed through, even though he's only 18. Lopetegui didn't play him. I think he played in two league games in total and just a few minutes in each of those. And that was genuinely, much as Vinicius himself probably doesn't even realise this, one of the elements in the kind of breakdown of the club's faith in Julian Lopetegui, with the fact that Vinicius wasn't playing. He came on this weekend under Santi Solari, who of course is the interim manager managing his second game after the cup game in midweek, and he scores the goal that kind of breaks all the pressure down and suddenly puts Madrid into a winning position. But I say he scores the goal, his shot was going out for a throw-in. Hit a defender and went in, and suddenly there he is bowing before the Bernabeu.
So did Solari pick him because he thinks he's good, or he picked him because he thought it might help him get the job for any longer?
Well, I mean, fairness to Solari, I mean, obviously anyone who comes in as an interim manager is in a difficult position and knows that every decision will be kind of analysed and counter-analysed and every word will be, you know, read between the lines. And Solari understands that very well. He's very, very bright. He's been at the club for a very long time as a player and then, of course, working through the youth system as a coach as well. I mean, it's also worth pointing out, you know, he put him on for 20 minutes. He didn't start him. He didn't give him the whole game. I think he also recognised that, that Vinicius can give you something different around you, if nothing else, because he's someone who runs at people, who's quite exciting, who kind of at least sort of makes things happen. And you know, if you're going to be charitable towards him, he might have won the lottery. He might have been very lucky. But to use the old cliche, you only win the lottery if you buy a ticket. And you know, he did take the shot, albeit, as I say, an absolutely dreadful one. But he'd run past the player, he'd run into the area to give himself the chance to shoot. So there was a sense of excitement about him. And now, even more so, you know, this has become a really big thing now. You know, this guy's got to play, and there's been debates, and there's been the normal thing, that the online polls, and he's got to play ahead of Bale, and he's got to play ahead of Asensio. Both of them got whistled a little bit when they were taken off. And this is the great hope. And, of course, the problem is, that as an 18-year-old, there is a risk that if you build him up like that, you damage him rather than thrust him into a position where he can be a brilliant player. I mean, you know, he might turn out to be Pelé, but we don't know that yet. And he's almost been treated as if he already was.
Sid, how unpopular is Gareth Bale with the Burnabout crowd? I saw he was voted, they really took against him in some online poll.
Yeah, I mean, there was a poll. This is a poll. Like, I think it was Ask that ran it, and you know, you have to bear in mind the kind of the context of all of these polls that Ask run. their desire is basically to point the finger at everyone at Real Madrid, and in particular at the club's president, which of course can be done on some levels, but maybe on not on all of them. And the question was basically, you know, who do you blame for Real Madrid's problems? And there was a lot of finger pointing at Sergio Ramos. There was a lot of finger pointing at Marco Asensio, who hasn't taken that step up that everyone expected him to. There's no doubt that he's a fantastically talented player. And I personally think he will be a brilliant player for a very long time to come, but he hasn't had a good season. Bale, I think, was partly pointed and singled out because, you know, in the post-Ronaldo era, he was supposed to be the guy that took the step up. He was supposed to be the guy that kind of led the team. And it hasn't really happened this season. I mean, there's been a couple of injuries. There's been a few games when he hasn't played well. I think he's now on his worst run without a goal at Real Madrid. But I wouldn't go so far as to say the Bernabeu fans hate him. I think there's a frustration with him because obviously Gareth Bale's record is actually brilliant in terms of goals scored, in terms of assists, in terms of what he won, in terms of how decisive he's been for Real Madrid. But I think there is always a feeling that even when he's decisive in terms of deciding games, he doesn't necessarily dominate them. He doesn't necessarily lead as much as perhaps they would like. So he's had the finger pointed at him, but not as much as Sergio Ramos. And this is why I mentioned the political thing earlier. Ramos is the club captain, and you know, we talked about this last week, as the person who came out and basically said, we don't want Conte. I mean, not in those words, but he might as well have done. As the person who was seen as kind of carrying too much weight in the dressing room, seeing as being too powerful. And also, you know, this is a person who has a, not quite an open confrontation, but certainly a kind of a slightly difficult relationship with the club's president. Now, the club's president is someone who will let that be known, but not publicly. And there was a report by one of the Spanish radios this weekend suggesting that group of fans behind the goal at the Bernabeu, which is a kind of a largely, I would say, semi-official group. I don't really know how best to describe them, but they're theoretically loud, the noisy, the radical fans, but actually they're kind of controlled at club level. They were apparently planning to whistle Ramos this weekend and was effectively told, please don't do this. You know, you can't publicly come out and criticise one of your own players in that way. Now, he got a few timid whistles, Ramos. When the penalty was won after the first Vinicius goal with 3 or 4 minutes to go, there were chances for Vinicius to take it. Ramos scored and then ran into this kind of Zen pose as if to say, you know, I'm not going to listen to these guys. And afterwards said, I'm delighted that I have a rucksack that people load up with stones all the time. But his relationship isn't good. And there was a very definite sense of pointing the finger at him this weekend.
Incredible comeback from Barcelona at Rayo Vallecano, Sid.
Yeah, and it shouldn't really have happened in the sense that they scored one very early. They were completely in control for 25 minutes. But Vallecas is a bit different. It's very noisy. It's a quite narrow pitch. It's quite a short pitch. It's quite a difficult place to play. In theory, although Barcelona's record there in the last 5 games, I think in the last 11 games, they scored 55 goals there, something crazy like that. And they were suddenly found themselves 2-1 down. And the way that Valverde put it, I really quite like this. He said it was he was asked if this was the ghost of Butarque, and he said, yeah, and everywhere we turned, we could see this ghost. Now, Butarque is the stadium where Leganés play. Leganés were bottom, Barcelona were beaten by them. Here they are against Rayo Vallecano, second bottom, losing 2-1, and thinking, wow, it's happening again. They then went a bit more direct. Gerard Piqué went up front as a kind of an auxiliary centre forward, and they got two goals in the last 4 minutes, one from Dembélé, which was brilliantly taken, and another from Suárez diving in to score. I think that's 9 league goals for Suárez now. I think I'm right in saying it's 6 goals in the last 5 games for him. He's really taken a step up without Messi. And Barcelona, yeah, a fantastic comeback. Dembélé's a bit curious, though, because he scores this brilliant goal and really does take it well. And yet he'd been bloody awful until then.
Messi's in the squad to play in. So is he likely to start that game?
I don't know. I mean, personally, I doubt it. But I suppose if you put him in the squad, it's because you think he's okay. I mean, I suppose the logical thing is that you play the way that they've been playing, because, of course, they've responded really well without him. They've beaten Inter, they've beaten Real Madrid, they've now had this comeback against Rayo Vallecano. And now you've got the international break coming up fairly soon as well. So perhaps you hang fire, make sure he's okay for the weekend, give him that little bit more training. But you have him there in case you need him, I guess. I suppose, in a way, the problem is that they're more likely to need him because he's there. I mean, it feels almost like they took responsibility on without him. And if he's sitting on the bench, maybe there will be that kind of sense of, you know, everyone just sort of falling in behind him again.
An exciting substitute appearance from Maxi Gomez in the Betis Vigo game.
I mean, the game was absolutely brilliant. If you get the chance, whether it's on YouTube or somewhere, try and see the first Betis goal scored by Lauren Moran. It was just an absolutely wonderful goal. I think the best goal I've seen this season. There's also a brilliant goal from Sergio Canales. Betis 2-0 up. But as you say, Maxi Gomez comes on, helps change the game. It finishes 3-3. And it was just brilliant. And the only thing, you know, the thing about the game was at the very end, they put the board up to say there's 3 additional minutes. And all you can think is, you absolute bastard. How can it only be 3? Come on, give us 15 of this at least. It was completely brilliant.
Sid, thanks as always for your time.
My pleasure.
Speak soon. Sid Lowe, out in Spain. Hey, Barry.
Yes.
Do you want to find out what happened in Serie A?
I'd love to find out.
All right, let's have a listen.
I actually don't know.
Oh, well, this will be fun for you and the listeners. It's Paolo Bandini.
Inter made it 7 straight wins in Serie A, 9 out of 10 in all competitions, by smashing Genoa 5-0 on Saturday. It was an emphatic result against opponents who drew with Juventus just last month, and probably Inter's best performance of the season so far. But what made it really remarkable is that the star of the game was João Mário. He was never even supposed to come back to the club this summer. Listeners may remember that he spent the second half of last season on loan at West Ham. And the player himself stated he had no intention of returning to San Siro as recently as June. But he followed that comment up by refusing a summer move to Turkey, couldn't find a buyer elsewhere, and wound up back training at the club again. I say training because he hadn't played a single minute until Inter's previous match away to Lazio, where he quite unexpectedly got named in the starting 11, and Inter won 3-0, with João Mário having a very good game. So now here we are a week later, and he's produced a star turn against Genoa, scored once, had his hand in 3 of the other 4 goals. And it's interesting because despite some other great results, Inter hadn't actually played very well for a lot of this run they're on. It's encouraging now to see them put together consecutive excellent performances, but it's also a little bit awkward because João Mário and also Roberto Gagliardini, who scored twice on Saturday, have both been left off their Champions League list. Inter had a smaller than usual squad size imposed due to their breach of FFP regulations, and so neither of those players, as who again were the stars of the win against Genoa, are going to be able to play against Barcelona on Tuesday night. But they did also get Raja Nainggolan back in this game. He came off the bench for 3 minutes, scored the final goal. So he should be good to play against Barcelona. And it's all positive for them on the domestic front, certainly. Inter up to joint second alongside Napoli, who themselves beat Empoli 5-1. Juve, of course, still out in front after an unconvincing 3-1 win over Cagliari, which means that all of Italy's Champions League representatives go into the midweek round in fine form, except for Roma, who drew 1-1 with Fiorentina.
Thank you so much, Paolo. In Ligue 1, first beat second as PSG won 2-1 over Lille on Friday night. Kylian Mbappe got his 11th league goal in just his 8th appearance. Only 6 of those were starts as well. PSG up to 12 wins from their 12 games, 41 goals for, 7 against. It's as if, Mark, they might win the title there.
Yeah, it's not looking good, is it, for Lille? That result also broke the record in Europe's big leagues of the best start ever, which had been held since 1960, and the Tottenham side that won the double, but PSG have now beaten that, and it was in the second half, it was pretty convincing.
Montpellier moved up to second with a 3-0 win over Marseille. Late last night, they're a meagre 11 points behind PSG. The bottom six all lost, including Monaco, who went 1-0 down away to Reims. Thierry Henry is still looking for his first win as manager. How are they doing?
Terrible. they're playing even worse than the results suggest, actually. He's been very critical of the players for not adapting to how he wants them to play. And Monaco are not known for their ultras, but they're even that they were sort of abused by the visiting fans that watched that game at the weekend for another inept performance.
How does he want them to play? I mean, there's a lot of me hopes that he just wants to play dirty long ball, you know, sort of John Beck style.
It would be good, wouldn't it? But it's the modern way. You know, he's very much influenced by Pep Guardiola and what he sort of taught him at Barcelona. So he wants them to play his possession football, but they're playing possession football, but it's very slow, and that I think is the worst type of football. It's so boring.
Do you think he's showing them how to do that, or do you think he's just saying, listen, you know, City, can you just do what they do?
That's like the idea of him going up and down the touchline in a Clio shouting, hit the channels. Hey Barry,
yeah,
do you want to find out what happened in the Bundesliga?
Yes,
great. Do you know?
I have a fair idea, but
okay.
Who better than Archie Rintott to refresh my memory?
Absolute great intro, Barry. Here he is.
Greetings from Cologne, where the weekend's agenda off the pitch was dominated by magazine Der Spiegel with their latest from the Football Leaks revelations. Their front page read, Der Verrat, the betrayal, as they revealed Bayern Munich had looked into leaving the Bundesliga 2 years ago. Club chairman Karl-Heinz Rummenigge confirmed that on Saturday, but said he had no knowledge of a possible agreement to be signed this month by top clubs, including Bayern, to form a breakaway from the Champions League. So to the football. And back to Bayern, because despite taking the lead at home to Freiburg in the 80th minute through Serge Gnabry, they still managed to draw 1-1, Lucas Hurler's goal, meaning that Manuel Neuer hasn't been able to keep out any of the last 8 shots at him in the Bundesliga, a run stretching back 4 games. Other headline from that was Thomas Müller's wife, Lisa, posting a barber coach Niko Kovac on Instagram, sarcastically suggesting that 71 minutes in, he'd finally had a brainwave by bringing on her husband. That didn't look great for Bayern, and neither does the table right now, because ahead of travelling to Dortmund next weekend, they're in third, 4 points behind the league leaders, Dortmund, who won 1-0 away at Wolfsburg thanks to Marco Reus's header. Obligatory mention that Jadon Sancho's cross helped set that up. To Sancho's best friend, Reiss Nelson, who I went to watch in Leverkusen on Saturday, he scored a fantastic goal too. Corner played short to him, one touch and bang, the Arsenal loanee curled into the top corner for the opener, cupped his ear to the crowd, beer thrown at him for his troubles, didn't care. 5 goals now in 6 games for him this season. Hoffenheim won 4-1 as well. Elsewhere, one team to watch right now at Eintracht Frankfurt, sizzling front three of Luka Jovic, Sebastian Haller and Ante Rebic all lining up together for the first time this season, all shining in their 3-0 win at Lowly Stuttgart. Frankfurt up to fifth, RB Leipzig in fourth, a point behind Bayern, winning 2-0 at Hertha, Timo Werner with both goals, and above Bayern in second, Gladbach, 3-0 winners in a Rhein derby against Fortuna Düsseldorf, but not a performance which suggested they'll be there for long. Finally, favourite bit of the weekend, Nuremberg drew 2-2 at Augsburg. Their goal scorers were Fuchs and Mühl, which is quite the coincidence because Nuremberg coach Michel Kölner is from a place called Fuchsmühl. Don't know if there's a term to describe what that is, but yeah, there you go.
Thank you, Archie. And so the Football Leak story, the betrayal, as he says in Der Spiegel, what do you make of it?
I absolutely love the Champions League. Write about it, speak about it, just can't absorb enough of it. And yet I'd be totally cold at the idea of, you know, watching it all the time. And I've not had one sort of football fan even come up with a half kind of logical reason or any kind of excitement for wanting to watch this kind of no promotion, no relegation, I don't know, Paris Saint-Germain versus Inter, you know, on a Saturday night somewhere. It doesn't whet the appetite for anybody other than the money men. I'd be very surprised if it did come to fruition. I think this is more likely to be a kind of a kind of power move by the big clubs, because there's a lot of talk about maybe moving the Champions League games to weekends and putting the domestic action in midweek. And I just wonder if that is kind of
where
they may settle. Arsene Wenger has spoken about this when he was Arsenal manager last season, you know, the future of football. And it definitely feels like that it's something that the UEFA would want as well, because obviously there's a lot of TV money to be had from sort of a Saturday night, you know, rather than a Tuesday night, for instance. So that's what I think, one to keep an eye on when they come through for the next contract.
So the idea is there'd be 11 of Europe's biggest clubs known as the founders and 5 initial guests, and the founders couldn't be relegated. Mm. So you could finish above 3 founders at the bottom and still go down because, well, the founders can't go. We can't go down from our. I mean, it's ridiculous, yeah. Greg.
It's against everything. But the big selling point of football is that small clubs can get into leagues and get promoted and aim for the stars and get there. And I mean, Leicester won the league, got into the Champions League, got to the quarterfinals, and really, you know, had a great time along the way. Now that is the selling point of football. If you shut it off and say nobody can come in, it's a closed club, the appeal's gone.
You say that, but if it happened and this league existed, we would still cover it. People would still go to it. It would still be on TV. It would annoy us because. It would, but it wouldn't. The game wouldn't die, would it? I mean, I don't want it to happen.
Would it have a broader appeal, though, with fans of other clubs, perhaps? Or do you think there could be a big turn-off from it? I think there could be. You know, they always talk about the bubble bursting, and it hasn't burst. People still love to absorb football in all its forms. But I think fans of other clubs who weren't involved in that might just find it such a turn-off that they don't engage with it.
Maybe, but then... just rivalries would change, right? You know, in the same way that me and Baz had Barney on the wireless yesterday saying, you know, young people now support players, you know. You know, there are lots of people in Nuneaton who support Real Madrid. Mm. That just didn't happen 30 years ago, right?
Mm. I was once in a pub where somebody shouted, "Come on, Premier League!" at the telly, because Liverpool were playing Spanish, I think, I can't remember, somebody in Spain, and that is, yeah, that's an example of that, I suppose, that there is that appeal.
Barry, what's your take on the Football Leaks story?
Just every fibre of my being thinks it's a terrible idea. It's clearly all about money, and I think it is an inevitability that it will happen. But
yeah, perhaps not in 3 years, I guess, but...
I do, you know, agree also with Mark that it's... a power play by these big clubs, but I would struggle to be particularly interested in a tournament like that.
What on earth are Marseille doing kind of the next tier? I saw that they've sort of got these 11 founders, and then it's Atletico Madrid, Borussia Dortmund, Inter, Roma. And Marseille, I mean, what are they going to offer this European Super?
It's like if you just saw and it was Southampton. Yeah.
Mark Hughes.
I expect the research was looking at clubs' Facebook pages and seeing which clubs had the most likes.
Yeah, probably. It also alleges separate documents show that Manchester City and PSG avoided financial fair play sanctions with the intervention of Gianni Infantino. I mean, is he worse than Blatter?
I wouldn't say worse. Not sure how much better he is than Sepp Blatter. It's quite funny, isn't it, though, that, you know, the Man City fans absolutely hate UEFA. Yeah. And they boo the anthem, and it you know, if this alleged report is true, they've actually been done a favour by UEFA.
Champions League is back this week. It's completely my fault that we didn't. Not totally my fault, slightly my fault that we didn't do these previews where we normally do them after we've talked about the games at the weekend. Tuesday, Spurs, PSV and Inter Barca in that group, and Red Star, Liverpool, Napoli, PSG. I mean, Spurs, Mark, need a ridiculous set of results to qualify, don't they?
They do. They need to beat PSV at home, then Inter at home, and probably a Barcelona that they'll be hoping by then have already qualified. And they also need Barca to do them a favour at San Siro. I suspect they'll get their part of the job done, but Barcelona maybe don't need to win that game away to Inter. So,
did you say the Spurs have thrown away this group? You know, they were winning at Inter, and, you know, Icardi scored that great volley. They were winning at PSV. Yes, I mean, Messi was ridiculous in the Barcelona game, but
They have. Yeah, I mean, they could quite easily have won both of those away matches and then they'd almost be through. So, yeah, I suppose they have thrown it away. I would also say, though, that it's about as hard a draw as they probably could have got. Barcelona, you know, were as good as they really could get in pot one because they couldn't play an English team. They've ended up with Inter in pot four when, you know, Liverpool have got Red Star, for instance. And then even PSV are well clear in the Eredivisie, and they're clear of an Ajax team that's, you know, just outplayed Bayern Munich a few weeks ago. So I think it's a difficult group, but you are right that they were in position to have won two of those games.
Greg, we touched on Shaqiri not travelling with Liverpool to Red Star, but it should be pretty regulation for them. And they've done well so far.
Yeah, and I think Liverpool have benefited a bit from the makeup of the league in that they've had these two Red Star games in the middle to get the points on the board and give themselves a good position, you know, at the top of the table going into the two more difficult games again at the end against Napoli and PSG. I think, yeah, they've got to go there and win that game. It's as simple as that, really. And I'm sure it'll be a hostile atmosphere, but they've played in games in other arenas just as difficult and come through them.
On Wednesday, Man City play Shakhtar. Juve versus Manchester United. Barry, which are you most excited about in that one?
I looking forward to both. I mean, Manchester City beat Shakhtar quite easily in the last game, but Shakhtar were missing their two best players and the two Brazilian midfielders whose names are
Marlos and Tyson.
Thank you. Will they
sounds
be
like
back,
your two
Mark?
Dogs, yes. Doesn't it, Mark?
I'm not sure. I saw Shakhtar beat Dynamo Kiev at the weekend, but I'm not sure if they're back.
Yeah, but so they're an attractive side to watch. I wouldn't give them much hope against City, but it should be an entertaining spectacle.
And as always, fascinating to see what Jose does at Juventus, Mark.
I suspect he'll do what he would like to do in all of these away games, and that's shut the game out. But they've only got one domestic clean sheet this season. I mean, that defence just isn't capable, really, of playing that way. So they would be better on the front foot, but I don't suppose that they'll play that way.
To Paraguay now. Fernando Olivar, who is 2 months short of his 15th birthday, scored the opening goal for Paraguayan top-flight team Cerro Porteña in their Super Clásico against arch-rivals Olimpia. He's 14. He's totally, really made his debut last week. He started this game. It's just ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. And you wonder, is it right? Should there be...
Was it child labour, are you saying?
Well, kind of, yeah. Not. It just seems he's a child in a very butch, manly environment. And I kind of, you know, while I applaud him, he's obviously clearly very good. I just, it doesn't sit really well with me. I'm not sure how I'd feel if he was, say, my son, if I'd be comfortable with that. But
there's an interesting thing happening in the Australian women's team. They've had a couple of 15-year-old players recently, and the dad of one of them, I think her name's Alicia Fowler, has said, oh, no, I'm going to take her away to, like, a training camp somewhere now and let her develop there, because it's not right that she's developing in international football rather than just, you know, training and getting better.
There's a girl on the British amateur boxing team that's going to the World Championships in India later this month called Lauren Price, and she used to play football for Wales, and I'm pretty sure she played for Wales when she was 15. You know, it's just so young, but clearly, again, a very talented girl.
The youngest player to ever play professional football, Mauricio Valdivieso, played in Bolivia's top division, aged 12.
Wow.
It's quite possible that when they walked out holding the hand of a mascot, that he was younger than the mascot he was holding the hand of. 12.
So you just wouldn't tackle him, would you? If you're on the opposition team, you'd just be scared to death. The police would come at you.
You wouldn't want Kevin Muscat or something like that on the other side, would you?
Can't imagine. Congratulations to Yeovil Town Ladies in the WSL, by the way. They've won a competitive match for the first time since 2016, ending a run of 41 games without victory by beating Everton Ladies in the top division. They leapfrog Everton at the bottom. Arsenal are 3 points clear at the top. Lovely tweet.
Sorry, just going back to the young players. Didn't Fulham field a 15-year-old earlier this season?
They did, and there was a lot of talk as to why they did that sort of suggestion that basically every Premier League team is after him and he can't sign pro contract yet. And, you know, they're desperately trying to kind of show him there's a pathway to the first team, and that was their way of trying to keep hold of him.
Back to Maurizio Valdiviesa, who producer Jonathan's done some research. He's now 22. He's played for six teams already. Is he the youngest journeyman ever? Do you think people are saying
his testimonial year if he'd stayed at the same place?
Does it ever turn out well for 15-year-old debutants? Because I'm thinking about Jermaine Pennant's appearance on Jeremy Kyle's show recently.
I didn't see the episode, was it? I mean, I don't watch many of them, I'll be honest.
I just saw he was, you know, was jabbering at somebody.
I mean, it's hard to come out well, isn't it?
He was also putting his former clubs on Wikipedia, the Jeremy Kyle show sort of appearances one at the end of it as well.
This is from at Football Quick Cliches. Bad weekend for nominative determinism. Chinese League One outfit Dalian Transcendence were relegated to League Two. Jimbo, presumably not that one, says, I can't believe the pod didn't highlight the real issues around the 48-team World Cup, which is the huge cost implications for middle-aged men completing the sticker book. This is from Philly Red on the discussion and the confusion about weevils and weebles. Weebles being the little toys that I remember. Weevils, Barry's, you remember, tiny little insects. Philly Red says, Max is right, they're weebles. Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down, I think, as the advert said. And as far as I know, they don't live in biscuits. Thank you also to Clement, who has got the slightly the wrong end of the stick, because we were either talking about weevils or weebles, but he says, hi, Max, Barry and co, my name's Clement, and I'm a civil engineer who specialises in highways based in Croydon. My ears perked up when you mentioned weeble bollards at the end of last week's pod. Weebles are flexible one-piece, passively safe, reflective bollards. Essentially, councils put these bollards in areas where there are lots of bad drivers. They should bounce back when hit. I live and work in Croydon, so you wouldn't be surprised to see these are quite common in urban area highway designs. I'm surprised Max knew what weebles were. I didn't. I wasn't talking about bollards at all.
It's kind of the same principle. And
he says, He says, I'm surprised Max knew what weebles were, as he doesn't come across as a knowledgeable bloke. Thank you, Clement. I felt bad the others podders took the mick for this nugget of knowledge I would only expect engineering nerds to understand. Keep up the good work, and could I have a shout out to my fiance Stella, who doesn't understand how I don't fall asleep listening to you, as she always does on long car journeys. Barry would like to say hello to Stella.
Hello to Stella, and I'm surprised you find us boring if you're having to listen to that kind of chat.
Anyway, that's the most we've talked about bollards, but it is important to talk about something that none of the other football podcasts will talk about. So if you'd like to nominate us for Football Supporters Federation Podcast of the Year, you can go to the website. There's no comment section on the page, so you can't reference the bollard chat, but if you've enjoyed it, we'll do plenty more of it next week or on Thursday when we're back. But for the time being, thank you, Mark Langdon.
Thanks, Max.
Thank you, Greg Bitkowski. I'll see you on Saturday.
Black
definitely. Shorts, red socks.
Okay.
I'm not going to pick you, Barry, but okay. See you on Thursday.
Never mind the bollards.
Okay, we'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.